animation, like any other art form, is not a marathon, it's a relay. And each generation takes the baton, remakes it to their own taste, and then passes it on to the next.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by an animation historian who's written for the New York Times, Variety, and National Public Radio. His 22 books include The Disney That Never Was, Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation, and Animation for the People, an illustrated history of the National Film Board of Canada. Charles Solomon, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Very nice to meet you.
So, Charles, we mentioned that you've written a number of books about animation, art, and history. Something that I noticed right away when I open up one of your books is the quality of the art, the color reproductions, the line work. It's really been only in recent years, recent decades, that you've seen animation art, comic art in museums. And I'm assuming that you've developed your eye working with folks at museums. You've been involved with exhibitions. You've written essays for museum catalogs.
Well, I actually started out with 2 degrees in cultural history. I was cutting my intellectual teeth looking at great painters and printmakers and sculptors. And there is a continuity. The artists at Disney who really developed the art of animation were graduates from top art schools. They had some of the best art instructors in the country, people like Don Graham, Enrico Lebrun, and Palmer Schappe, all teaching there and learning what goes into drawing the human figure accurately. How do you capture movement in a way that is believable? You have to make it clear that the figure is moving against gravity. And your audience may not know, oh, they got the rhythm of that walk wrong, but they'll know something doesn't look right if you don't have that basis. And then artists and other places, whether the Warner Brothers and MGM cartoonists or more individual artists like the Hubleys and many of the National Film Board artists, go on to take that knowledge and stylize it and push it in new directions and do things with it for comic or dramatic effect. But they still have that underlying knowledge that's the basis of drawing and just putting a line on paper in a way that will communicate. Animation doesn't exist in a vacuum. The people who make it are generally very knowledgeable artists, people like Milt Kahl, who had been married to a woman who ran a gallery for a while and became infatuated with Picasso. Mark Davis studied animal anatomy and the art of Papua New Guinea. So they brought all this to their work, and by sort of helping to explain this to your audience, I think you give them more respect for the filmmakers and a greater understanding of what they're looking at.
Yeah, you bring a lot of that cultural history and that technical know-how to this big book that you're famous for. It's called Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation. It's about as exhaustive as it comes in going from the silent era to modern day.
Well, I was born at a convenient time so that when I began writing, I was in grad school, many of the old artists were still alive and could be interviewed. And in those days, newspapers were big. You know, the Friday art section of the LA Times might be 24, 28, 36 pages. So there was space they needed to fill. And I could go to the editors I worked with and say, you know, like, hey, they're re-releasing this Disney feature. I could interview Mark Davis about the villainesses and how he created Cruella de Vil or Maleficent in this film. Or, you know, there are these interesting new artists, Glenn Keane, Matt Groening, Hayao Miyazaki. They're really doing some interesting new stuff. Let's do something about them. Or for a book I'm working on right now, when I first saw The Family Dog and said, there's a director named Brad Bird. You got to let me write a piece about him. This is something new and really good.
Well, before we talk about your book, Animation for the People, let's give a little background about the National Film Board of Canada.
Okay.
Before the NFB, there was an agency with the lilting name of the Canadian Government Motion Picture Bureau, and this started back in the silent era at the end of World War I.
Yeah, it just kind of sings, doesn't it? They had, I mean, aside from them, there was virtually no filmmaking in Canada then. There weren't studios. American companies sometimes, came up to shoot things on location. And that government agency was getting very ossified and very stale. They were still making silent films in 1934. It's a little behind the times, maybe. So people of in power in Canada realized we need to kind of upgrade and update. And they found John Grierson, a Scot who was a great scholar of film. He only made one film, but he understood it and analyzed it and wrote about it and coined the term documentary. And he basically came up with the idea of the National Film Board. Grierson was one of those inspiring leaders. He was intense. He was a heavy drinker. He had a temper, but he believed in film. And although he had conceived of the board as a peacetime entity, by the time it was created, Canada was at war as part of the, British Commonwealth. And so you had a huge country, I think it's close to 10 million square kilometers, but it only had about 11 million people scattered amid this continent-sized expanse of land who were divided in many ways, linguistically and geographically and culturally. And Grierson's mission was to bring the people of Canada together, saying, we've got to make them realize they are a great people. And you don't do that by forcing them, you persuade them. And so he saw the board as a way of uniting the country and uniting them behind the war effort. And not only were many of the films dealing with wartime themes and newsreels, he saw to it that even the people in the remote little villages scattered across the prairies and into the far north got to see the films because they equipped, there were men who had very, very sturdy projectors, generators, and reels of film, and they went out by car and boat and dog sled to these little villages and showed the films in grange halls and barns and community buildings and schools. And he did what he set out to do, but he was apparently a fascinating man and one that, as busy as his schedule was, if someone brought up an idea about a film that he liked, he would just stop and sit down and talk about it with them. He also did not only the board, but the world of animation and the art of animation a favor by hiring another Scotsman, Norman McLaren, to set up the animation division of the board. McLaren wasn't exactly ecstatic about that. He wanted to make films, and people who knew him said, well, you could only talk so much to Norman because his mind was on what he was filming and what technique he was inventing. Genius is a horribly overused word in our culture. I think animation has probably produced four. Winsor McCay, who creates the art form out of nothing. Walt Disney, who completely transforms the art of animation to something no one, even the animators, had thought it could become. Hayao Miyazaki, who in some ways is doing the same thing in our time. And then McLaren, who invented techniques and ways of creating imagery and analyzing movement and animation to a degree that no one had really done before, and no one else has done with the same kind of insight and creativity. There were people who had tried putting images directly on film, but they didn't work the way his did. Or lots of people had created artificial sound going back to the 20s in Hungary. But no one used it as effectively as he did in a film like Neighbors. Sometimes when you put something in a solution, everything will crystallize around it. And he was that kind of force in that world of animation that his work was inspiring and exciting. He encouraged young artists, and his films were the greatest recruitment tool you could find.
Like you tell it in the book, John Grierson and Norman McLaren were both very charismatic, very visionary people, both Scotsmen, but radically different in their personalities. I mean, John Grierson was gruff. He had been studying mass media and propaganda in the United States, which
Right.
helped a great deal when World War II broke out. McLaren, Norman McLaren, he had seen the brutality of the Spanish Civil War. He doesn't want to do pro-war propaganda. So it's a little bit awkward. Here he is, tapped to head up the new animation studio at the National Film Board in the 1940s. So most of the work that he does himself has to do with promoting solidarity at home, buying war bonds, things like that.
Well, it's what we would call PSAs, public service ads today, or spots. And yeah, it's mail early, put your money in bonds. It's Christmas, so get your packages in the mail, those kinds of things. But he's also working on the chant populaire, the popular song films, which were another kind of cultural bonding experience. The idea that you take these old folk songs that everybody knows and you get people in theaters singing along with them. The Fleischers had experimented with something similar in the 20s with the song Cartoons, where we get the phrase follow the bouncing ball. And these were, again, chances to do something that weren't standard Hollywood style cartoons at all. C'est l'aviron, it's the paddle, is this kind of fantasy journey down a Canadian river. And he did little partial landscapes in gouache, mostly white and gray on black backgrounds. And it's one long series of dissolves that are overlapping. So you fade from one image into the other so slowly you don't realize it's happening, but you feel like you're just gliding down this fantasy Canadian river. Nobody had ever done anything like that before.
Yeah, McLaren really had a passion for experimentation, and that became infectious at the National Film Board. He tried out different techniques himself, paint on film, pixelation, and other artists were playing around with paint on glass, with this technology called pin screen animation. So there was, at least early on, this real culture of if it doesn't work out, try something new.
Well, and if it doesn't work, that doesn't, you wouldn't be fired. Not every experiment succeeds. And you were allowed to put a personal spin. You mentioned paint on glass. You have three really interesting women artists, Carolyn Leaf, Martine Chartrand, and Wendy Tilby, all of whom use paint on glass completely differently. Their styles, the content of their films are so different. And that was fine, just because Carolyn had pretty much pioneered it with one look and one kind of motion, didn't mean that anyone expected Wendy to work the same way or to produce the same kind of film, or yet again, Martine, who's doing something completely different that's closer to the work of the Russian artist Alexander Petrov. But they're still all working at the board, they're still all producing paint on glass films that are highly personal and very much in the tradition that McLaren envisioned of the individual artist probably working under the camera alone. So this goes back to something I've talked about in many books is from the inception of animation on film, there's always been a dichotomy between studio cartoons, which are like operas, it requires a huge crew all working together, and if they're working together properly, the results are staggering. Versus it as a real extension of the traditional graphic and visual arts, where it may be one or two people working alone, pursuing some individual vision that is as personal as any canvas or etching or engraving or sculpture. So this is very much that second tradition of animation, the individual art form that one artist can express him or herself in ways that no one else probably can do. How does Carolyn Leaf, move the figures around in the street, particularly towards the end where you're moving in three dimensions and the laundry is blowing overhead and The little boy is leapfrogging over a fire hydrant.
This is the adaptation of the Mordecai Richler story, The Street.
Yes. How do you think that way? I don't know, but there's would be no way to do something like that in a conventional commercial studio.
Speaking of autonomy and individual expression, the animated shorts commissioned by the National Film Board, I mean, they'd be entertaining, but they would often still be public service films. The government might say, make a film about fire safety or job resources, but then beyond that, the filmmaker would have a pretty free hand with the content.
Yeah, well, a good example, two examples of that come to mind. One are Pig Bird, that was one of Richard Condy's first films, where someone smuggles in this weird-looking creature, brings it home, starts to pet it, and all these bugs start pouring off it. And they attack not only the idiot who violated the customs laws, but his yard, and then as the camera pulls back, his town, the whole province, and the entire globe. And it's absurd and it's hilarious. But it makes its point. In some ways, in the tradition of films like the tax films that Disney did for the government during World War II, or that the private snafus that Warner Brothers and MGM did to help train the GIs, that they realized that humor was a way to make these points, and it would stick in people's memories in a way that a don't do this lecture wouldn't.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with animation historian Charles Solomon, author of the books Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation, The Man Who Leapt Through Film, The Art of Mamoru Hosoda, and Animation for the People, An Illustrated History of the National Film Board of Canada. Now, one story that you tell in the book that's really indicative of the reach of the National Film Board, in the 1970s, there was a separatist movement in French-speaking Quebec, and the Canadian broadcasting system was eager to try and mend the breach. And so a short story by Roche Carrier was adapted to film by animator Sheldon Cohen.
Yes, that's The Sweater, which is one of the most viewed films in the history of the board. And Carrier was a rising literary star in Quebec at the time. And they gave him the question, what do the Quebecois want? And instead of trying to write some political tract, he did this memoir of being a little boy in a tiny rural village in Quebec and the trauma he had had when his mother bought him a Toronto Maple Leafs sweater rather than a Montreal Canadiens sweater, which was led by Maurice Rocket Richard. And this was, the end of the world for an adolescent boy at that time. And Sheldon said that he was initially a little reluctant because he came from an urban Jewish English-speaking milieu. He didn't play hockey, but the story was so good, who could resist it? And Carrier narrates it with a very, distinctive voice and a very much Quebecois accent. The only change he made in that was he said when he showed it, Norman McLaren came and liked it, but he said it goes a little flat at the ending. You should probably just fill up the screen with more moths. And so Sheldon said, with great trepidation, I went to this noted artist and said, would you mind changing the last line of your story to something like 10 million moths to come and eat the sweater? And he said, no problem, and re-recorded the line. And now the film ends on that note.
Well, on the other side of the country, some of the most memorable animated shorts came from the prairie provinces. The animators out west had a gift for comedy, and that became known as the Winnipeg style. The most
Right.
popular examples are probably Richard Condy's The Big Snit and Cordell Barker's The Cat Came Back.
Yes, I mean, both hilarious films, both that still bring down the house wherever you show them. If you go to any sort of revival, or when I was teaching at UCLA, I would show that, and the whole class would just be on the floor laughing at those two films. There's just a take no prisoners absurdity to it. They aren't necessarily the most exquisitely drawn films the board ever released, but they don't need to be. And while there's some influence of the Warner Brothers MGM, slapstick humor of the classic cartoons, they give it their own Canadian spin and an absurdity to it. When you look at the Big Snit, even the backgrounds are funny. If you not only are the in one place, there's a picture hanging with its face to the wall. There are, of course, saw marks in the walls and in the furniture. There's a bugle hanging over the bed, and there's a DC-10 tire in the dining room. And that's the way these people live, thank you very much. And they're comfortable that way. But beneath the absurdity of that film, you still realize that these people love each other. You said you've had David Silverman as a guest on the show. And he said when he and Wes Archer were doing the first animation of the Simpsons characters, those films were an inspiration to them. They were their own drawings that were coming onto the screen, and they wanted that same absurdity and to get that kind of laugh through the drawings.
This was when The Simpsons were on the Tracey Ullman show. They were the little short vignettes before it
Yes.
became a regular show. And
Yeah, it was
so
like
they were,
90 seconds a week, I think.
so the animators were watching. The cat came back and taking notes.
Yeah, and learning from it, which is how any art form works. I remember one interview I did with Miyazaki. He said that animation, like any other art form, is not a marathon, it's a relay. And each generation takes the baton, remakes it to their own taste, and then passes it on to the next. And he said, one day, I'll be ready to pass it on if someone's there and wants to receive it. And that's very much what you get with some of the work of any great studio, whether it's Disney or the National Film Board or Aardman, that they're all, oh yeah, I was influenced by this, I watched this and learned from that. And that baton keeps getting passed. And it's just that the people of Canada have been extraordinarily generous in giving us this place where artists can experiment and develop and grow and try and bring us things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to see.
There's storm clouds on the horizon. I want to get your opinion on this. When I talk to art instructors and they show their students concept art, like the kind in your books, a lot of the young people will say, oh, that's generative AI, artificial intelligence. It's like everybody is suspicious that any art that has a high level of mastery must be generative AI.
Well, that's depressing. And that's, clearly one of the big questions facing all the arts at this point is where will this go? How will it be used? How will it be misused? In this country, art schools don't teach drawing anymore, which is, I think, a grave mistake. And when you talk to artists in Europe or in Asia and see their work, you see the difference. When I went to the University at Salamanca a couple of years ago, they have a library of bones. If you're drawing something and really want to study a femur, you can go and check one out and take it to your house and sketch it and study it and measure it and understand its forms and its complexities so that when you go to draw it in something finished, you'll know how to do it. There's no substitute for that. Walt Disney always believed in that kind of research. That's why he built the educational program that transformed animation at his studio. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about understanding anatomy and how the artists on Bambi studied real animals. And Rico Lebrun, I think it was dissecting a roadkill deer for them that was getting riper and riper, and they were sort of drawing with their sketch pads at arm's length. But by understanding the musculature and the joints, they could make Bambi move like a believable deer. And that process goes on today.
So you've written extensively about Japanese animation, There is a big book that you've published. It's called The Man Who Leapt Through Film, The Art of Mamoru Hosoda. Now, here in the West, a lot of people are familiar with the animation director Hayao Miyazaki. Some others will recognize the names Isao Takahata and Satoshi Kon. Mamoru Hosoda hasn't gotten the same cachet, even though his feature film Mirai was nominated for an Oscar back in 2019.
Well, I remember the first film I saw of Hosoda's was Summer Wars, and I was so taken with it. I wrote about it, interviewed him, and wrote about his other films. And when the chance came to do the book about him, I was delighted to do it. Yes, I've interviewed Miyazaki, I interviewed Takahata, but there's a whole group of younger directors in Japan, Hosoda, Makoto Shinkai, Masaaki Yuasa, Kenji Kamiyama, who are the next wave. And they're doing things that are exciting and interesting and new. And I think all of those younger directors have learned from the Ghibli artists. Miyazaki is just so good and so prominent. Of course, everyone studied his work and watched it and been influenced by it. And it is a very different culture with very different assumptions, and it's one of the reasons I've been studying Japanese is to try and understand some of those concepts better, that there are words for things in Japanese that we don't have in English or other Western languages, and vice versa. You know, there's the whole concept, for example, in art of ma, which is the empty space around something which you bear in mind when you are creating something, whether it's a brush stroke that has to sum up everything in one sure movement, or a bonsai, or a garden, or something in an animated film. You have to be aware of that. Again, there's no, I don't know of an English word that really corresponds to that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Konser, and my guest today has been Charles Solomon, author of the books The Art of the Disney Golden Books, The Art and Making of Peanuts Animation, celebrating 50 years of television specials, and Animation for the People, an illustrated history of the National Film Board of Canada. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, more about your books, where would they look?
I have a page on Amazon, like everybody else. That's probably the best place. I'll have a History of Cartoon Saloon coming out this summer. Other people who are doing really interesting work that's different from what we do in this country. I don't have a website, or I'm not on social media. Ursula Le Guin, who was a dear friend from Portland, and I had a standing joke that we belong to an anti-social network where everybody left everybody else in peace. So I've never had a website or anything like that, but I do have a page on Amazon.
That's a great note to go out on. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.